Boom, 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 bop. Boom, 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 bop. Boom, 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 bop. Boom, 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 bop. Boom, 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 bop. Boom.
Welcome, guys. Welcome back. Welcome, girls. Welcome, boys. Welcome, new guests. This is Who's Your Therapist? I'm your host, Ari Shapiro. This is my show. This is me trying to record an intro with lots of traffic going on behind me, but we're going to make this work. So for anyone that's tuning in for the first time, this is a show where I bring on different therapists and we talk about what goes on in their lives. And our lives, where we have an opportunity not to be the perfect therapist and the expert, but to tell our story. And it's a place where we can be vulnerable. It's a place where we can talk about what we've been through, where we've been, where we're going, what we've learned along the way, and what we're still working on too, because we're all beautifully flawed and we're all a work in progress. In so many different ways. So welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you guys tuned in. I'm really excited about this episode for a few different reasons. My guest today is Kimberly Nesker. And Kim and I, we actually go back a long time. I think we met at Thornhill Secondary School in grade 11. And we became friends. And then as soon as we moved on to university, we lost touch. And all these years later, one of us came across the other one's name in a networking group, and it was like, oh, you do this too? So this is a bit of a different episode today, actually, for anybody that may be listening for the first time or for anyone that's been following along this journey. If I could boil it down a little bit, it's a bit of a brain injury episode. And it's a conversation I had with Kim where she talks very candidly about the brain injury that her partner experienced and what that was like for him, but also for her as the caregiver. And it was also a platform for me to discuss some of my brain injury as well and how that went. So I think it was a really interesting conversation and very forthright, very candid. And I've suddenly run out of things to say. I really hope you guys enjoy this episode, and please, I was going to say put your hands together. Please get ready to get to know Kim. You mentioned your hubby. Mm-hmm. How's he feeling these days? Because I remember a year or two ago, he went through something that was potentially very scary.
It was. It's still hard to talk about. Yeah. I'm not going to lie.
Okay. I was wondering if it actually was the opposite, where it felt like it was so long ago now that it doesn't even sort of feel like anything anymore.
I think because of what happened to him, and I don't mind going into it and I don't mind sharing, you know, just to, again, make it a bit broader. He was diagnosed with spontaneous cerebral spinal fluid leakage. Which is a puncture of his dura sac that there's no reason for it. I mean, every doctor that we spoke to was like, you know, the chances are like 1 in 2.5 million.
Oh my God.
It's one of those things where you can have like the tiniest bit of your bone, like, because obviously in your dura sac there's pieces of bone because there's spinal fluid rushing around.
Okay.
And so tiny little fragments of bone, like particles of sand, will break off.
Yeah.
And if one of these particles gets stuck on an area of your spine that happens to be closer to the dura sac, and it happens to be sharp enough, and it happens to hit, like, all, it's like the rare earth theory. Like, all these things have to happen.
Yeah.
It can puncture the dura sac.
Jeez.
And actually, the most famous person that this happened to was George Clooney.
Really?
Apparently, he experienced this. He fell on the set of Syriana and developed a cerebral spinal fluid leak. He's the one who's kind of made it popular, or at least known.
Popular, like popular. The thing to do.
The thing to do. Yeah. He's at least acknowledged it more in the medical community.
Sure.
They're starting to realize that this is something that is much more likely to happen to men and women between the ages of 35 and 45. Don't know why. So unfortunately for my husband, he had two. He had a fast leak in his lower thoracic and a slow leak in his upper thoracic.
I mean, it's like I almost found it comical how bad that is. Like, yeah.
Well, he was on his back for almost...
What do you mean two? Like, yeah. It's crazy.
Like, one isn't enough. Like, we don't do thing, and we don't do anything small in our family. It's always go big or go home.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, he was on his back for about 3 months. He couldn't even sit up to eat. So like sliding food across a plate into his mouth, going to the bathroom, he would be crawling on the floor, often vomiting on his way to the bathroom. And because his brain had sagged so dramatically, he had actually pulled all the ventricles from his skull, and he had 2 subdural hematomas as well. The only fluid in his brain was blood. Yeah.
How bad can this be? Like, how much worse can this
well,
get?
Well, when we finally got him to a CT scan, he was lying in the bed. They had run him through, and they apparently, I wasn't in the room, but according to my husband, they kind of ended it early, pulled him out, and were like, can you take a phone call?
Huh?
And they put him on the phone with a neurologist while still on the bed for the CAT scan. The neurologist kind of said to him, he's like, okay, we need to get you here now. And we were put, taken from the bed on the CT scan onto a gurney, into an ambulance, and immediately transferred to Toronto Western.
Okay.
And as you probably know, the triage system in Canadian healthcare, if you get moved that quickly...
Yeah.
Like, we were just like, what is going on? What is happening? And we were told quite bluntly, he's in severe, severe danger. And that's kind of where I just, like, I went from being like, we just got to get this handled to I'm breaking. Because he went from being in bed to being on 24-hour monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't let him sleep. He was up every 2 hours for 2 weeks doing the, you know, my name is blank, blank, blank.
I get it.
You know, like he had to squeeze hands. Like, and for weeks afterwards, he would wake up in the middle of the night and put his hands up and say his name and where he was and the date. Like, just the effect of it was ridiculous.
So there's a lot of similarities there. I had to do that too.
I'm waiting to hear, because you have told me that something similar has happened to you, but I've still not heard your story.
Mm. Well, continue, please.
The long and the short of it was, you know, there's 3 people in all of North America who are trained to deal with cerebral spinal fluid leaks. One of them is in Mount Sinai in California. Okay. One is in New York. And one is at Toronto Western.
Well... Fucking A.
Yeah, there's no other way of saying it.
You know what? Well, I was told Toronto Western is like the number one neuro hospital in Canada.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. I will hands down say that considering what we went through.
Yeah.
But the reason why we have a lot of trouble with it is there have been side effects. Like for weeks after he got out, his personality was very, very different.
Oh.
And I was very, very worried.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the man that I had... keep in mind, this all happened a week before our first year anniversary. And so I was like, I finally find the man of my dreams and you're going to take him from me? Like, what is wrong with this world?
Oh,
I felt very, very, well, I felt very, very much like the world had no justice to it.
Yeah.
But he came around, he got back to himself. But for us, the real reason why we have so much trouble with this is that the doctor who saved my husband's life, you know, 3 weeks after my husband was released from hospital, a week after he had his first follow-up with this man, this man who sat with me every morning at 6:30 in the morning and held my hand and talked me through every procedure and took as long as he needed with me, despite the fact that every other doctor in that place hated me. Because I would come in at 6 o'clock in the morning and be like, you're not leaving until I know exactly what you're going to do today and what's going to... Because if you miss the rounds...
Of course.
You don't know what's going on.
Right, right.
So they all hated me. I was much despised by all the medical staff. But yeah, 3 weeks after my husband was released, that same incredibly brilliant neurologist who quarterbacked our team and managed to make sure that my husband lived...
I feel like I know where you're going with this.
Murdered his own wife... put her body into a suitcase and threw that suitcase over an overpass on his way into the ER.
So he was your doctor. Wow. Yeah.
And the fact that he is always on the news, there was almost a year to the day of the anniversary of what happened to my husband. Toronto Life released a whole magazine solely about what this doctor had done and who he was and what was going on and the after effects. And it's like, well, that's a trigger right there. That's a trigger. And he still has horrific headaches. And for a long time, you know, he would cough and he would get a headache and he would burst into tears for fear that this was another...
Like it was coming back.
It was coming back because it would be a similar headache to what he had experienced. And what we've since learned is that, no, you know, three to four months of just bouncing your brain around in your head without any fluid to kind of keep it safe, he's more or less got concussion-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though he didn't have a concussion, the weight and the hematomas have left residual effects. So he now has, I would say, headaches about 4 to 5 times a week. And they're not like, thankfully, they're not migraines, but they're enough that, you know, he's like, oh, he takes a Tylenol daily.
Hmm.
And it's now he's going to have to get used to living with this chronic pain. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
so tell me what happened to you.
I'm happy to tell you about that. So I'm curious to ask, though, before I do, when that sort of that news came out about that doctor and that article was published, and you said that was a trigger. In what way was that a trigger? Like how did that?
Well, every time people talk about this doctor, we can't help but think about his connection to us.
Right.
So and there's no other point to that connection except how we know that doctor and what happened to us. So every time, and people love to talk about it, right? And also what happened to my husband, because it's one of those things that it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Right? So it's sensational, and people love a good sensational story. And so it does. It gets brought up quite a bit.
Okay. So the triggering is even just something that reminds you of that time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I gotcha.
For me, it's much more specific.
Mm-hmm.
But for him, I mean, we'll be watching something on Netflix and someone will have to go into the hospital. And if there's needles involved or there's anything to do with the brain, I can still watch my husband visibly cringe. Like, I can still see it.
Yeah.
I can still see how he, you know, he just kind of goes.
Wow.
So, and it's been, 3 years? It's been almost 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so it still has a very huge effect on him. On me, as you can tell, I can talk about it now without bursting into tears, but it's still difficult.
Yeah.
It's still a really hard subject to broach because how can I put this? I'm a problem solver. I think one of the reasons why people like you and I tend to go into this world is that we tend to be a bit more problem solver of that mentality.
Yeah.
And so to be someone who's a problem solver, to be someone who's a doer, and to be that powerless.
Helpless.
And helpless.
Yeah.
It was very, very, I don't have any other words for it, but big. It was huge. It was life-changing. It
would be like soul-crushing.
Yeah.
Like, not to get overly dramatic here, but I imagine the impact of it is almost like too much for words.
Yes. Yeah. I consider myself an incredibly strong person, and I can take a lot. And, you know, I'm very good at doing the whole, you know, I'll worry about it when it's something I need to worry about. And I'm very good, I wouldn't say at compartmentalizing, but recognizing when worry is becoming ineffective. And so I've always been very good at kind of recognizing, okay, I need to step back, or I need to do this, or I need to do that. This was the first time I can honestly say that I broke. Like, there were times where I just had to leave the room and I'd be in the hallway and I would just be like back against the wall, shoved down into like fetal position, just howling and crying because I couldn't get the doctors to come to the room. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, there's only so much information that I can gather that I actually understand without having a medical degree.
I mean, it's like gibberish, even if that's your first language.
Yeah, even if you have a background in the sciences, it's still like, wait, I'm sorry. There's so much that I need to know, and I just can't.
Yeah.
And at the same time, to have, you know, the man that I love lying in a bed saying things like, you know, please don't go home. or, you know, I wait for your return in the morning. And it's like, well, how do I sleep when I know that you're waiting for me and you're not getting to sleep? Or I would have people who would offer to come by and help who ended up being more of a hindrance. You know, like they would come over to help me and to spend time with me and my husband in the hospital. And then they'd be sitting beside me going like, well, where do I go to get a coffee? And what do I do if I want to do this? And I'd be like, can you just figure that out on your own?
Yeah.
Like, can you please not ask me to problem solve anything else right now?
Yeah. Oh my God.
So it was, there's so many other things that were, you know, it wasn't just what was going on in the hospital room. It was all the other things of, not only am I trying to manage my own fears and my own concerns and my own insecurities, I'm also trying to assuage and comfort the love of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also trying to deal with everyone else who's asking questions. And it's like, you know, the term that I kept trying to use that only a few people really understood was, I need to grieve out. You can't put this pressure on me. I need to go out. You need to go out.
Yeah.
Like, you can't, I'm going to be in the middle part of a pile and I'm going to suffocate. So out.
Right. Wow. So it's interesting for me to hear about it from your perspective, because mm-hmm. for me, I was, you know, I relate more to the,
what being happened?
The guy in the bed.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I was very fortunate that I had, when I was in the hospital, the overnights and all that stuff, I had probably about 6 to 8 different people that were like on a rotational basis, like one of them would stay with me overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have that many people to kind of, they all coordinated it and just made it happen. It was so amazing
mm-hmm.
that I had just sort of that big of a support team that didn't have to all be on one person.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I can relate to so many things that you're saying. Like when shit hit the fan for me, I was in Japan.
You were in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened? How did it start for you?
It started months before. I had a CT scan for a completely unrelated ailment. So I did the CT scan and then I got a phone call the next day saying, you need to come back to our office. And I'm like, that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
So he sat me down. He said, you know, we got your scan back and we don't know what this is, but you have a mass in your brain that's right now it's the size of 1.5 centimeters.
Oh my God.
So you need to see somebody about this.
Oh my God.
And at that time I would never have known because I wasn't experiencing any related symptoms. And it went on like that for months. I had the consultation with the neurologist. I had the consultation afterwards with the neurosurgeon at Toronto Western. And at this point, it was like March. The time frame is like when shit hit the fan, that was in August. And like I said, no symptoms. And they said, well, we really can't tell what this is, but we don't think it's a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little bit relieving, although the part where they said we don't know for sure was still terrifying. They said likely what we think it is like a hemorrhage or a hematoma from this cluster of blood vessels that were not fully formed. That's called a cavernoma. And at some point in time, it must have ruptured. We don't know why. There's no reason for it. And it caused this blood clot that we think is just going to go away on its own. So we're going to see you in 6 months. And when you do, we're probably not even going to see anything there anymore. I said, okay. And before I left, I asked the question. I said, just out of curiosity, how will I know if it's getting worse? And it was in my cerebellum. So they said, well, you'll know because you won't be able to walk anymore. So I said, okay, thank you very much. And I went on my way.
Okay.
So like I said, and no symptoms until probably the beginning of August, I started getting a headache.
Yeah.
And it was like an everyday headache that just got worse every day for probably about 3 weeks.
And it just kept getting worse and worse over the days of those 3 weeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And I kept going to different doctors. Like I went to about 3 different doctors and I said, look, this is what's happening. This is what was diagnosed earlier in the year. I'm supposed to be going to Japan soon. Is what I'm experiencing from that, like, should I be going? And each one of them said, Okay, well, follow my finger around. You can do that good. Oh, you're fine.
Really?
Yeah.
They said that was the most invasive test they decided to do.
Yeah. They said it's probably just a strain and it's triggering like a migraine. And it'll get better over time. You'll be fine. So I went to Japan, and within about 24 hours, I mean, at this point, when I say like headache, pain, it was like pain like I'd never imagined before. It was excruciating.
But then you went on a plane where you had highly pressurized air.
Yeah, and it felt better. It felt better while I was on the plane.
Really?
Yeah.
But then coming down.
Coming down, yeah, I didn't notice anything like instantaneous, but, you know, I touched the ground and then, yeah, it started feeling pretty crappy, which to me was just like, oh, it's feeling crappy again. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really sure if it was worse. It was bad. It was at the point where I thought, well, I just got to wait this out and it'll get better. Mm-hmm. And two, I was with my brother and I was so determined not to let this interfere with like his good time.
Yeah. You're in Japan.
So yeah. So I just sucked it up but by, you know, 24 hours later, all of a sudden I couldn't walk anymore. And I was like, oh, this is not good. This is bad.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So you're in a foreign country.
Yeah.
With a foreign health service. And you're trying to explain to Japanese people who might not speak English what's going on.
Oh yeah. You. And the best part of the timing was that the weekend that this happened was a countrywide religious holiday to which many hospitals were closed.
Oh my goodness.
Like closed. So the first...
It's like a comedy of errors.
Yeah. So the first hospital I went to was closed and I was sent away. And the hospital that finally received me was like it was an abandoned hospital. I mean, we went in through the ER. There was nobody there. The lights were off in the hallways. Finally, we were greeted by a nurse who got me to fill out some forms and gave me a thermometer. And remember,
thermometer.
I stuck the thermometer in my mouth and she went away and I'm filling out these forms. And she came back a couple minutes later with just this look of horror on her face. And she said something which I couldn't, like, she didn't speak English. I didn't speak Japanese. Thankfully, I had an acquaintance with me from Japan who had accompanied me to the hospital who could translate. I said, what did she say? And she said, that's not a mouth thermometer.
Oh my God.
How the fuck would I know? You just gave me a thermometer.
Dealing with the culture difference.
Yes, yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, I mean, that I thought, even in the midst of what I was going through, that was kind of funny to me.
Well, you have to be able to see the comedy of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, that was great. And long story short, we got a new CT scan done, and the blood clot that was 1.5 centimeters was now 5 centimeters.
Oh my goodness.
And so, yeah, major shock. And the doctor that was with me, I think she was an orthopedic surgeon. She was like the one doctor that had to be on call for the whole weekend because it's a holiday and people don't work. So she said, there's two options here. Either one, we admit you into the hospital right away and you're going to have to wait until Monday to see a neurologist. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you're probably going to have to be in the hospital for at least a month. And I'm thinking, that sounds terrible because, I mean, there was no, like, communication.
Mm-hmm.
Huge language barrier. The only reason we were able to have some communication was because of my friend that was there. So I really didn't like that option. She said, the other option is you get on a plane right now and you go home and you go right into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So
wow.
Went there and, I mean, like the triage system, they took me right into at least a bed.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough, I actually didn't go in for surgery for another couple of days because mm-hmm. what I kept being told was people are coming in through the emerge that are in an even more dire situation.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, yeah, like the same thing. I had to be monitored, I think it was every hour. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to come by and wake me up and, do you know your name? Do you know where you are? Can you know, squeeze your hand and all that stuff? And mm-hmm. what's the date? And so I was, wow. I was told that my brain had been pushed so out of alignment from the blood clot that my ventricles were building up with spinal fluid to the point where they could burst.
So you had the opposite. Yeah. You had too much fluid.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was like...
How was the surgery?
As far as I know, it was quick. Like it was, I think, 3 hours or less.
Yeah.
The surgeon was amazing. Apparently it went really well. And I was so naive. I thought like, oh, they'll get rid of the blood clot and it'll take the pressure off of my brain and I'll just go back to normal. And it was it was a couple of months until somebody finally told me like, no, that part of your brain is damaged now. Mm-hmm. Like you got to relearn now how to do all these kind of functional tasks. So
if you don't mind me asking, what tasks did you have to relearn?
Well, walking.
You had to relearn how to walk.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were in physical therapy for learning how to walk again.
Yeah.
How many months?
Probably altogether, the transition from wheelchair to walker to cane to on my own was about 5 to 6 months.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I felt like it went pretty well.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly.
It did go very quickly, and then, but still.
And then the amazing thing is like by the summertime, so almost a year later, I was like playing tennis. And I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. Like I went from like, yeah, basically like that first month at home needed to be waited on hand and foot. Like I couldn't move much. I couldn't, yeah.
Wow.
Eating and all that stuff, showering.
Yep. All those things that you take for granted.
I'm sure, huh? You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, like, yeah.
Make sure somebody was with me to like, yeah. Yeah. All that stuff.
One of my husband's favorite memories was what he refers to as the three-way he had with his wife and his nurse, because all he remembers was the sponge bath. And
so good.
He's just like, I don't remember much of what happened there, but I do remember that there were two women around my naked body. And I was like, yeah, babe, it wasn't as sexy as you think it was. But yeah, I mean, I want to ask you, because again, you know, coming at this from what we do for a living, did you ever give up? Did you ever have that moment where you were just like, that's it, my world has changed? Did you ever let go of a part of you?
I'm glad you brought this up, because this is actually one of my favorite parts to talk about. Mm. And it's so influenced by our work. So from the get-go, I made sure my mind was right, meaning my expectation was not that I was going to get back to normal, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. My expectation, or my hope, I should say, my hope was to get stronger. The hope was never to fully recover, if recovery meant the way it was before. I was always embracing of the fact that whatever this looks like, to whatever extent, it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. It's never going to be exactly the same as it was before. Mm-hmm. And by embracing that, I was able to embrace the entire experience and look at it from the point of view of, this is a fucking gnarly adventure. And I was kind of psyched in a way to be like, where is this going to take me?
What happens, right?
Like, this is going to be a journey and an adventure. And like, this is going to be...
Pardon me.
That's okay. So for the most part, I was upbeat.
Yeah, your psychological health was really strong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
It says something, right? Because mm-hmm. I know that was something that I really kind of... How can I put this? I made that message true. Like I brought it home every day, every time that my husband would make a comment of, well, what if? And I would be like, no, like we're not working from that perspective. We're working from the perspective of, yeah, your brain's going to be different. Mm-hmm. Right? Your brain's going to be slightly different. We don't yet know how, but you know, you're going to be slightly different and we're both going to adjust with what that means and what that works. Or how that works.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to hear that you had that perspective too, because you're spot on, right? There's mm-hmm. it's so important to be able to look at it from to use the ridiculous vernacular, from a gain frame as opposed to a loss frame, right?
And it really
there's a part of me that sits here with a smile on my face, Ari, and thinks to myself, the reason that you probably got where you did in 4 to 5 months, which could have easily taken a year, right? We're talking about significant physiotherapy, right? Mm-hmm. You're teaching yourself to rewalk. You're remaking those synaptic firings in your brain. You're reorganizing all of those patterns when your brain is no longer nearly as plastic as it used to be. And you have to wonder, how much did that perspective keep you on that path? And how much did that help you to get better faster?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's one of those...
It's amazing.
It really is. It's one of those moments where you're just kind of like, I can take this in my own hands and I can make it work. Or I can live in that place of, woe is me.
Mm-hmm.
And why am I not who I used to be?
And I think that's a big part of it. I felt very much... It's funny. It's almost funny to say I felt very much in control.
Did you feel empowered?
Yeah. I felt like to wherever this ends up going, it's not about the outcome. I felt very much capable of, to whatever it was worth, to feeling like I could do something good for myself. So it's almost like I felt, empowered a bit.
Yeah.
I had that mentality from the get-go. I had recently started training in martial arts earlier that year. So I felt like that had sort of bolstered my mind and my body a bit too.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be very fortunate. A friend of mine is a music therapist and he had just come back from a neurological music therapy conference. So he was saying, okay, your hands still work? Yeah, okay. Get your guitar and start teaching yourself as many new songs as possible. So every day I would be learning a new song and I felt like I'm doing good for myself. Mm-hmm. Like I can do something to affect the outcome of this. So I always felt very connected to wherever this journey was going to take me.
Mm-hmm. It almost feels, in hearing your story, Ari, it almost feels like the recovery is so much bigger, such a bigger part of the story than the actual illness itself.
Absolutely.
Right?
There's a part of it that makes me smile too. And it sounds crazy to say this, but there's a part of me that almost wants to say, like, it was almost like fun reminiscing about that time and just thinking about what I did, because it just felt, what I was doing felt like I was doing such a good thing.
I'm glad you said that, because for us, and again, I wish that I could talk about it primarily from his perspective, but I can only talk about it from our perspective, because I wasn't on the table, I wasn't on the bed, but I was 100% there. One of the things that my husband and I will often say is, one, because it happened literally right before our first anniversary, and we still celebrate our first anniversary.
Okay, good.
We went to Niagara Falls. It was fun. He won $500 at the table, or at a slot machine.
Nice.
It was really, I'm like, there's your karma right there.
There it is.
But we had this moment where we realized how much closer it had brought us, how much more bonded we were just by going through that experience. And also, it allowed both of us to kind of talk to each other on various different levels, right? So on one level, about how much we came together, right? And how we in that moment really became a team, right? We became 100% a team. But at the same time, you know, there were moments where I was not my best self, you know, in my own fear, I was not my best self. There was an issue where after he had gotten the patch and we were still in the hospital waiting for everything to kind of go and start up again, they had to put these, what they called magic socks on him. And they were just like these, for lack of a better way of saying it, looked like leg warmers.
Okay.
But they had like pumping options. And the whole idea was, because he had been on his back for as long as he had, they were worried about him standing up and starting to move around, causing blood clots and causing other issues.
Sure.
So they put him in these magic socks.
Okay.
It felt very Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
Like, these are my magic socks. and they kept saying things like, he has to walk around with them on and he has to get out of bed and he has to move. And my husband was very resistant and he was very scared, because every time before that he would get up, he would have pain.
Yeah.
So any opportunity for him to stand up or do something on his own, he was you know, he was very childlike for lack, and he would be like, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to. And so when I say I wasn't my best self, he saw the tough love side of Kim.
Mm-hmm.
Right. He saw a very tough love side of me.
Yeah.
Which he had never seen before. And he was, and it frightened him. Because there was actually, there was one day where I said to him, like, if you don't get out of bed and you don't walk around the halls with me, I'm going to go home. Because there's no point in me staying here and watching, you know, Family Guy with you in your bed when the doctors keep coming in and telling you you have to do the physical therapy.
Wow.
If you're not going to do the physical therapy, I'm not going to stay. And he refused to get out of bed. And I got into a cab and I went home. I came back like 20 minutes later, you know, but still like he had to experience that. And, and, you know, for after he got out, we were talking about the situation. He would say, you know, that was really scary for me. He's like, I felt like you were giving up on me. And we had, and so we then had to talk about what it felt like and why I felt like I had to give up on him, quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made us stronger and enforced all sorts of our communication styles. And we had always been super good at communicating. I mean, as anyone will know, it's probably the worst thing in the world to be married to a therapist because it's like, no, babe, let's talk about our feelings.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, this was something where he really felt like he had learned how to communicate with me on a different level as well. And there were other things that came out of it as well. Like he talks about how when he was lying there and, you know, he would have these flashes of, lucid thoughts over the drugs and over everything else. All right. And he would have these thoughts about, you know, he wanted to do this kind of a show, or he wanted to do this movie, and he wanted to do this, or he wanted to do that. And when he came out and he got the A-OK, and the doctor said, okay, now you can go back to whatever you want to do. You can drink alcohol again. You can, you know, if you want to smoke marijuana, you can smoke marijuana. If you want to do this, you can do nothing was taken off the table. He had no more restrictions. He was like, I'm going to make something of this experience. Right. And so the year that we've just had in development for him were a lot of those shows that he had come up with.
Wow.
And a lot of those ideas that he had had while he was lying like immobile.
That's incredible.
Months. And really like so much has come out of it. He got right back into going to the gym and got like super, super heavy into working out again. Made himself really, really like his physical health became a really big thing for him. This is one of the reasons why I love him. He has a minor in psychology.
Okay.
So he started reading up on those things again. He started getting right back into Buddhism, and he started getting back into holistic thinking and stuff like that. And all this stuff kind of opened up for him. And really, it all came out of this idea of, you know, I had 6 months of my life where I couldn't think.
Yeah.
Right. Like he felt like his brain was literally not working. And he had 6 months where he was just like, I felt so not me, and like desperately holding on to the threads of who I thought I was, that when he came out, he was just like, I'm going to do something with this. And he really did. And like you, he had this mentality of no more waiting.
Yeah.
If I'm going to do anything, I'm going to do it right now, and I'm going to do it hard. And like you, he's come out very much on the other side with all of this opportunity and all of this growth. I mean, you have to kind of look back and go, this could have been something that broke me.
Yeah.
Right. Especially, and I'm in your situation, especially if you had been stuck in Japan, right?
Yeah.
That could have easily swallowed your soul to have been stuck in a hospital for a month. Yes, recuperating, but without any connection to anything.
Yeah.
Feeling very much an outsider in your own healthcare, not knowing what was going on. That could have broken you.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I imagine that at one point when I was home and after the surgery, and the thought was terrifying to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
And I love that you, like, well, I don't love that you had this experience, obviously, but I love what you did with the experience.
Yeah. Well, I'll add one, you know, I'll take that up a notch. Part of me does love that I had this experience.
You can.
Sorry. Yeah.
You can love it.
Right.
I won't love it if you had that experience.
No, okay. Understandable. But I mean, I look at this experience as so enriching to my life. mm-hmm. bringing me closer with people, and also, yeah, sort of becoming more attuned to certain things, like not waiting for, and other sort of important life lessons that unfortunately, sometimes it takes something terrible happening before you kind of get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I can now say with some of the people I work with who have been through hell, what's the best thing that's happened because of the horrible thing that you've gone through?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it might sound a bit crass or insensitive to say that, but I feel like, well, I mean, I'm very open with letting them know I've come back from something pretty extreme too. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I can say that.
You can own it, right?
Yeah.
You can take that and have ownership over it and say, well, you know, I'm not saying I'm the only way to look at a situation that's bad,
yeah.
but this is how I chose to deal with it.
Like, there's good things that can come out of
mm-hmm.
this. So that's kind of cool.
It is.
Yeah.
And what a level of connection that you can make with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's definitely something I noticed. That I when you have something this big that happens to you, I think it would be a detriment to what we do for a living to not bring it into the therapy.
Right. Right.
To not bring in that personal experience. And, you know, I have this experience where I kind of witnessed it from the outside. And then I have this other experience and from back when you and I went to high school together.
Yeah.
I don't even know if you knew back then, but I used to dance.
Okay. I don't know.
Probably right before you and I started hanging out, because
mm-hmm.
that's when everything changed. Right when I was just turning 16, I damaged both my knees. Well, technically my left knee. And then
okay.
I spent 10 years putting all the pressure on the right knee.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah. And so in high school, I had to give up my dream.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't know that. Yeah, that was my dream. I was going to be a professional dancer. I was never good enough. I can look back now with hindsight and I can honestly say it was probably a pipe dream and I probably was not in any way or shape or form good enough to make it professionally. But you know, when you're 15 years old and you're dancing and you're going in as often as I was, this was something I was going to do with my life.
Well, it sounded like it was your life.
It was.
To a certain
I mean,
extent.
I was dancing quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then like that, it was like, wait a second. What do you mean? And I was the girl who, you know, that was the time when Sex and the City was a big thing. And as girls, strappy sandals were a huge deal. I was not wearing strappy sandals. I was that girl who went to McGill and in the middle of the quad, my knees would just give out. Like I'd be walking and for no reason whatsoever, just like a sack of potatoes, I would just fall down.
My gosh.
And books would fly in the air and people would come running to help me. And I'd be like, oh my God, I'm so mortified. It happened right in the quad. Oh my God. Everyone knows. And also I lived on a street with a ballet school and I had to walk past that ballet school every day and watch all of those little ballerinas on their bar going.
So graceful.
So graceful.
So contemptuous now.
Damn you all. Knowing that I would, you know, like I have friends who are like, let's go to a dance class or let's do this or let's go to Zumba or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, can't.
Wow.
Can't do it. I have to live with the knowledge of knowing that, you know, God forbid if I'm ever assaulted or I'm chased, I can't run away. I'm sure the adrenaline would allow me to, but I will most likely tear my ACL and my MCL and I will never run again.
Oh my God.
So there's certain knowledges that, you know, I'm now 37. It's been 21 years of getting used to this.
Can I just say, I think we need to invest in a jetpack for you, like just in, for those situations.
Just in case. I'm going to go with the adrenaline,
being what
I need, and then I'll deal with the after effects.
Okay.
But you know, I've had 21 years to get used to what I call managing chronic pain. And I will often say to people, if my body had a zipper on it and I could take off my body and you could climb into it and zip up my body and just walk down the hall, I can guarantee that you would be screaming in pain.
Yeah.
You'd be screaming and you'd be looking at me going, how do you do this? But I have gotten one, so used to the pain, and two, so in charge of that pain, right? Because I know there is a way that I would never have to experience pain in my knees, and that involves me being in a wheelchair.
Hmm.
Right? That involves me not using my legs.
Yeah.
And that's not a good enough option for me, right? So I can deal with pain, and I can live my life with tiny little nuanced changes, right? So yeah, I can't wear heels. So what? I live in a world of flats. Okay. Right? And there are days where I have to put a knee brace on, or I have to ice my knee, or there are certain days where I have to tell my colleagues, can you bring my clients to me? Because I can't walk down the hall. Mm-hmm. But those days are few and rare. They're few and they're far between. And again, I would rather have those days and still be someone who walks and who does things. And I do. I mean, I'm not to say that I'm a hiker. I'm definitely not. I'm not an athlete because I don't think I can be. But that doesn't mean I don't hike. That doesn't mean I don't walk. That doesn't mean I don't do things. I mean, that's you've got to live.
Yeah.
Right? And so I always had that in my back pocket. And it was always something that I was able to kind of come back on and be like, you know, it's something that was always so crucial to an empathic connection with people when they were in pain, either emotional or physical. I could go back to both the emotionality and the physicality of what I dealt with. Mm-hmm. And then to have this happen later in life, when I had done so much work to develop all of those tools and techniques, and then lo and behold, they still weren't enough.
Ooh.
You know, lo and behold, I had developed all of these ways of managing and coming to terms with and changing my perspective and this and that. And then sure enough, there came another sucker punch from life. And I had to learn newer and even more advanced ways of dealing with it.
Oh my gosh.
But again, to be able to bring that into what we do. I mean, I know one of the things that you told me about this whole podcast is the idea of getting to know why therapists do what they do.
Yeah.
And I think one of those things is for a lot of people to realize that most therapists are coming from places where they've had to do this work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where they've had something happen and they've gone through the process of having someone help them out. Mm-hmm. Or they've seen a family member get helped out, or they've seen the effects of what we do can do for and right. That's why, right?
So
I think we've reached a nice stable place to stop for today.
Okay. I'm going to hit the stop button in a second.
Stop it. Stop it now.
Stop it. We had some fun there. It was, you know, it was just so nice catching up. And I'm so glad that we had a chance to get to do this. I want to give a big thank you to my guest today, Kim, for sharing candidly and giving me the opportunity to share some of my story as well. And maybe I'll use this opportunity also just to, there's so many people to thank, namely Hiroko and Hiro in Japan and Rodney, all of whom really helped to coordinate my medical care while I was in Japan, and was really a big part with that. I thank you guys so much. And to all my family and friends and supports back home, lots of love to you guys. And to everyone that's listening, thank you again so much for tuning in. Your support means so much to us here at the show. And if you get a chance to visit Apple Podcast, it would mean so much if you left us a favorable rating and a review. You know, to keep this show hopefully moving forward and gaining momentum. Yeah. Kim has been practicing in Toronto since 2012. She specializes in multidisciplinary psychotherapy. She works primarily with adults doing individual counseling. And you can definitely, I really highly recommend if you're in the Toronto area, look her up. You can find more about Kim's practice by going to her website at therapyfortotalhealth.ca, or you can check her out at Be Well Clinic, and I will leave the website address for that as well in the episode notes. If you're in the Halton area and you're thinking of giving therapy a try as well, feel free to give me a shout. My website will be in the episode notes too. So until next time, we'll see you back in a few weeks. But everybody that's listening, please keep fighting the good fight and keep trying to be productive. And if not being productive, then at least keep trying to do something that makes you feel good, makes you enjoy within reason. Don't go out and like rob any banks. All right, guys, have a good week.